The Viridian Nutrition range of 200-plus award-winning products includes vitamins, minerals, herbs, nutritional oils, specialty supplements, tinctures, and balms, all formulated to be healthful, efficacious, and pure. By choosing our Viridian Nutrition range, you are one step closer to your goal of 100% wellness. Ethical vitamins with an organic heart. Available at all Browns outlets. Browns and you.
Welcome, Emily Jones, to the She Warriors. Ordinary women with extraordinary stories is a bit of an ambiguous title because I actually believe that every woman has a story, but some stories are slightly more elevated than others. And your story, Emily, every time we sit down and we talk, you leave me jaw-dropped. So thank you so much for being part of this series that's part of the She Word. A welcome, and I'm really glad that we can do this. Emily, you are a content creator and have been for, since 2020, is that right?
About then.
And your content creation has changed, it's diversified, and you have changed and diversified, but you have this incredible backstory, and I'm really excited. Thank you so much for sitting with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to sit down and have a chat with you, and yeah, it's going to be good, I'm sure.
It's going to be great, and we've done, as I said, we've done this before, but this is the whole story, and this is what I'm really excited about. And I'm going to kick off by saying that you are Maltese and English.
Yes, exactly.
So did you grow up in the UK or did you grow up in Malta? Because you have a beautiful English accent.
Yeah, people are often a little bit confused about my background. I think mostly because of that, really. But yes, I was born in the UK, born in England. And my mum was English and my dad was Maltese. And when I was about, I was five, we moved to Malta. And then I grew up here, basically. I went to school here. I went to junior college, the government college here. I went to university here. So really, you know, my whole kind of education and childhood, adolescence and so on is all based in Malta.
Well, this is really interesting because there are two cultures that that both speak English.
Yes.
Malta has two national languages, one of them being English. But very, very, very different identities.
Yes, definitely. And I think that was a lot of my kind of growing up. And I think, honestly, I know that there will be a lot of people watching this who can relate, who are maybe, you know, come from families with mixed backgrounds. It's so common these days. But I often say that it's quite a kind of specific upbringing, being brought up in Malta. I also, like, had... I just kind of think of those as, like, the golden years. You know, Malta was just so beautiful at that time. You know, it was a very kind of different place to the sort of very fast-paced chaos of today. Certainly there was some aspects, there were some aspects of chaos at that time as well. But, you know, it was like super safe and really, I just remember it kind of being, you know, we would come to Malta for our family holidays to visit my grandma and things when I was really small before we moved here. So to me, Malta was like, what do you mean we're moving to Malta? You mean are we going to live where we go on holiday and have the best time ever? It was just
one huge holiday.
Yeah, it just felt like it was going to be an absolute Mediterranean dream. And that's kind of how I remember my childhood being, honestly. I just really loved growing up here. And then when I was... yes, we definitely did have that kind of mix of cultures, though. My dad did live in the UK for quite a long time, so he was also kind of somewhat anglicised, but then still also very Maltese. And I always say that I'm very grateful, well, to my parents for a lot of things. They were amazing, but a few things that they did, I feel, to make my upbringing in Malta feel quite special and also to be quite kind of successful with it. I feel like a lot of people, when they're sort of half something and half something else, there's a lot of sort of bashing or talking about Malta in a negative way. But, you know, my parents never spoke about Malta in that kind of way. You know, my mum would often go out with her, like, British expat mums and friends, and, you know, they'd sit and compare things to how things are in the UK. But my mum never brought that into my kind of impression of the island. She was always like, Malta's really, she always spoke about it in a very positive light, and I think that really impacted my experience.
So then how did you end up coming from Malta and having your education in Malta to going back to the UK? Yes. And having this amazing English accent.
Yeah. So then when I finished university in Malta, I just kind of knew that I wanted to experience living somewhere else. And actually an opportunity came up at the time with a company called Travel Channel. And I sort of had this idea that I really... Well, it's funny now that I do a lot of travel content, but that was always... I had this idea that I was going to be a travel journalist and a travel presenter on TV. So I found this opportunity... Where I found it, I couldn't possibly remember. Maybe it was on Facebook or something, I don't know. But I saw that the Travel Channel in London were looking for interns. I'd just finished my Bachelor of Communications in Malta and I was like, yeah, OK, I'm up for it. And I got the job and that was it, really. Then I moved to London and ended up basically staying there. And I thought I would stay there. You know, it kind of felt like my forever home, I would say, until my mum fell ill. And my mum and dad have lived in Malta throughout all of that time. And whilst I was in the UK, they were still here. And then when my mum fell ill, then I started spending a little bit more time in Malta and kind of got sucked back into spending a lot of time here.
But I do know that there was something else going on at the same time.
Right.
Which we've spoken about before.
Yes.
And that was your health.
Yes.
So your mum's health was failing, but
yes,
your health was failing as well.
Yes, yes.
And that influenced, somehow that influenced your journey. So
yeah,
what's happening
definitely
for you?
So as you say, there's so many like little different kind of stories that could be their almost their whole own episode. But around 2014 time, around then, I started to suffer from a lot of pain. I was suffering from a lot of chronic pain. Now, I was working in the city, in London at the time. I was actually in a recruitment role, which is a sales job for anybody who doesn't know. It's very fast-paced and quite cutthroat and very long hours sitting at the computer. And I wasn't sure whether it was that was impacting my health or, you know, I didn't know what was going on. But I was just starting to suffer from a lot of, like, widespread aches and pains.
Okay, so this is just pain everywhere.
Yes, I started to kind of feel as though my shoulders were really stiff and just things like when I would be getting changed at the end of the day, you know, I was sort of struggling to get my arms up past a certain
wow
point, things like that. And I actually had a very bad experience with my initial diagnosis of that because I did go and see somebody about it maybe a year or two prior to it being really bad and sort of said, you know, that I'm struggling with this. And the doctor did kind of dismiss me as being sort of, you know, you're just a little bit overweight and, you know, aren't exercising enough. You're spending too long at the computer and sort of poo-pooed me. So that's a story that kind of stayed with me a little bit because later on, you know, I actually had just started a new job with a new company. And within the first few weeks, I just had a really terrible flare-up.
What does that look like? What is a flare-up?
I suppose we should say that following that, I was then eventually diagnosed with inflammatory arthritis, which a lot of people will kind of be very familiar with rheumatoid arthritis,
yes,
which is one type of inflammatory arthritis. It's kind of all comes under one umbrella. And fibromyalgia, which is a different type of pain, but, you know, they're very kind of similar symptoms and characteristics. But yes, it caused me to have sort of widespread pain, mainly in areas that have joints, so your shoulders, your elbows, your knees, your hips, things like that. And when things were really bad for me, it was kind of a lot of stiffness and just not really being able to move very well.
But you hadn't, at this point, you didn't have a diagnosis and you're in pain, but you don't know why.
Yes, that's right. And I kind of, in the back of my mind, had this sort of doctor that I'd been to see who kind of had dismissed me. And I sort of had a little bit of, I think, some kind of like guilt and shame around it, sort of feeling like this is my fault and, you know, that kind of blame thing that you do. And I just sort of felt a bit silly, really. But then as I had this flare later on that was so much worse, and I just, you know, I could tell very quickly that it wasn't a case of just, you know, needing to exercise or lose a bit of weight. And I could see that something was obviously very seriously wrong. I mean, I thought that maybe I had some kind of, I don't know, a slipped disc maybe, but then obviously that wouldn't explain the pain in the shoulders. It was all very confusing. But then I was very lucky and ended up having a wonderful GP at my local practice who really kind of took me under his wing and was very, very kind. And it just shows like how different your experience can be in the medical world. I know that you've spoken about that a lot with a lot of other ladies' issues. But I was very lucky to find somebody who, you know, recognised right away that something wasn't right, took my concerns seriously. And honestly, the diagnosis of something like this, it does take quite a lot of time. But once you send off a blood test to test for inflammatory markers and they're through the roof and there's nothing really else going on, then you can tell quite quickly that somebody has an autoimmune disease like I did.
And fibromyalgia is what?
Just if fibro is more of a nervous system disorder that causes widespread pain, but also some other kind of almost sort of non-specific symptoms. So there's the diagnosis of fibromyalgia is actually quite difficult, but they do like an 11-point pain test where they sort of touch certain points which are, you know, not necessarily connected to a joint, just sort of tissue. And if you have random pain there, that's a very good sign. That's a very good starting point that you might have fibromyalgia. But people who have fibromyalgia also tend to be sort of somewhat overly sensitive people to external stimuli. So I would say that this has been my entire life is sort of unexplained tummy aches and headaches and all of these sort of aches and pains that you can't really describe. That was very much something that I suffered with a lot when I was growing up, as well as achy joints. You know, it's such a shame to realise now, because I guess I was into that. I guess I was around 24 when I had the diagnosis, which is pretty young. But you know, I could see that all of these times when I was sort of like lying down saying, oh, my legs are aching. And, you know, my parents would sort of say, it's growing pains. You know, that's what we used to kind of say at that time, that it's growing pains. And
so can I paint a picture and see if I've got this right?
Yes.
You're 24 years old, something like this. You're living in London. You're pursuing your dreams. Your parents are 2,000 kilometres away.
Yes.
And you're in excruciating pain. And for how long? About a year or so, there was no diagnosis.
Yeah, no diagnosis. And it would sort of come, flare up and then back down again. So it was sort of, you know, ibuprofen and get back to it kind of thing.
But
it
wow.
But I obviously wasn't doing very well.
And then you changed your job and it
became
chronic.
Then I changed my job and I had a massive flare up. I mean, you know, honestly, these types of conditions are very responsive to stress and anxiety. So if you are going through, you know, we talk a lot about kind of pacing yourself, and that's a big part of the diagnosis, and learning when you have to just kind of say no. I know that's a lesson that I'm sure a lot of people watching can resonate with. You know, we all have that, but when you do have a chronic condition, you really have to sort of learn where those boundaries are and when your energy is going to run out. But it's quite difficult to do, especially if mentally you're somebody who wants to be doing things.
And well, of course, you're in your mid-20s.
That's right.
And you're wanting to be doing some things, and you're also in the city, you're in London, in the one of the major capitals.
It was actually a very kind of isolating time, I have to be honest.
How else was this affecting you physically?
Well, it was really just to do with the fact that I couldn't kind of really manage the tube journey. I couldn't manage sort of getting up and down steps very well. I couldn't walk very far. Standing up and sitting down was like very hard on the hips and just very uncomfortable. I did for a period also walk with a cane for quite some time, which was very helpful and also served as a visual aid for people, because, you know, I think people would sort of see me and think, oh, God, you know, like young lady, young woman who's also, you know, I was a little bit, I wasn't huge, but I was certainly on the chubbier side, and people can be very judgmental. And I think they just sort of thought that you were just sort of lazy or unfit. So things like when I needed a seat on the tube, you know, having the walking stick really made a massive difference for things like that. But, you know, that's a whole other story. Invisible disability is such, I mean, I've got so many stories about that sort of being asking for assistance at the airport and being asked, you know, what's your disability then kind of thing by people in an aggressive way. So you do have to really learn how to advocate for yourself and speak up.
Can I ask you, Emily, it just occurred to me, and this is probably the first time it really has, because we've talked about this before, but it really has occurred to me, that you are a young woman in your mid-20s with an invisible disability and you've gained a bit of weight and you're kilometres, thousands of kilometres away from your family.
Yes.
What did it do to you as a person? I mean, this must have been a really challenging time.
It was. It really was. I mean, when I look back on it now, you know, it seems like quite a long time ago, but I do remember several things about it. But I do remember it being a very isolating time. I also felt that, you know, I wasn't performing well at work at all. I was very kind of preoccupied with this whole, the diagnosis, the medication. I mean, it was so full on. I was also taking sort of all these horrible, you know, some of the arthritis medications are so horrendous. Like I was on steroids for a very long time and it just has so many impacts on how you look and how you feel. It was just things like in my office, we didn't have a lift and we were working on the first floor. So for me to go to the toilet, I had to keep getting up and down the steps and, you know, it became a bit tricky. So they sort of set me up a desk downstairs, but I was on my own down there. Well, with another company, but not with my colleagues in my company.
Sure.
So it felt a little bit, you know, and then I was sort of coming with my walking stick and it kind of felt like I think people were sort of thinking, oh, God, what's going on with her? You know, it was all a bit... It was a bit isolating, I would say.
Confidence? Did it hit
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I also struggled a lot with the physical changes that kind of, you know, I really sort of... I mean, I definitely, like, ballooned up in weight, but also, you know, when you're on steroids, you get that kind of, that stereotypical, like, moon face appearance. So you just sort of look a little bit like a bit of a distorted version of yourself. And yeah, I did feel a bit, I mean, I felt a bit lost. I felt a bit confused about where on earth life was taking me. I'm actually very grateful that my, you know, I've always been very close with my mum and dad and that, you know, they were very sort of supportive about it all and really advocated for me doing what was right. Goodness, I always get emotional at the last moment that you... that you expect it, but it's true because I just really felt like people thought I was making it up.
Yeah.
I just really felt like nobody believed me and that they just thought I was like a lazy, overweight sort of, you know, didn't want to work kind of thing. And that's just not me at all. That's just not my personality. It never has been. But
it's one of the reasons I believe, and I believe this so deeply, that we should never judge someone else because nobody knows what someone else is going through.
That's right.
And like you say, you had an invisible disability.
Yes.
How did that work out? I mean, assuming that your company let you work from home and...
Unfortunately, in those days, I mean, it was a little bit complicated. As I say, my performance at work at the time wasn't great and I had kind of only just started there. So I think they were a little bit apprehensive, you know, a new hire suddenly having to be off every other day for a doctor's appointment and a hospital appointment and an MRI and this, that and the other. And obviously you're doing everything through the NHS in the UK. You've got to be there when they give you the appointment. You can't really pick and choose. And there was a lot that was going on with it. So I did end up losing my job. I mean, I was signed off for a long time and then we sort of came to an arrangement, basically. I was quite keen to work from home, but this was all pre-COVID.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, things are very different now, but at that time it was kind of seen as, you know, you're just going to be mucking about and not really doing what you need to be doing. But that probably would have been the best situation. But I do feel, you know, that things have worked out as they should in the end. But it was a shame. I mean, I found myself, you know, after I did lose my job, then I just kind of thought to myself, oh my goodness, where is this going? What am I doing? What am I going to be able to do physically? Because, you know, you're kind of also coming to terms with this new diagnosis.
Yes.
And then I had a very rough journey figuring out my medication. So I was on all different kinds of things to try to figure out something that would work for my arthritis but also not leave me with any debilitating side effects. And unfortunately, I went through like 6 different rounds of treatment. I tried everything, all of the typical drugs, and they all kind of disagreed with me. It was like migraines or vertigo.
Oh, wow.
Completely debilitating, rashes, this, that and the other, or vomiting. You know, it was a whole thing. So it really took a very long time for me to finally get on a medication. This is like, talking like, you know, 2.5 years after the diagnosis, finally getting onto something that was like, okay, this is helping the symptoms, but also not giving me any kind of nasty side effects. So that was, again, was just like, I feel so lucky that, you know, my medical team in the UK was so amazing with that, honestly, and very, again, took my concerns seriously and let me kind of go through the process and put me on this amazing medication that's just completely changed my life.
Okay, so you've gone through this and you found the medication that's working for you.
Yes.
And then I assume it's not much later. You've lost your job there in the UK, but you're still in the UK.
I just wasn't working at that time, so I was just sort of figuring out my health.
Figuring out your health, figuring out things, and I assume you got a call.
Yes. So it was, it was kind of, my mum had been a little bit unwell, just for like maybe 10 days or so, just sort of not really being herself, complaining of a headache, and then kind of having a couple of episodes of vomiting. So we were sort of like, okay, she got a bug or something. Doctor came and said, we probably got something's going round, this, that and the other. But she was just sort of acting a little bit out of character. It was a little bit strange. And then I got the call. Then I got the call that... first, it all happened a bit strangely, actually. She had gone in for a scan for an MRI where they discovered that she had a mass in her brain. And my dad had taken her back home to sort of get a few bits together to then go and be admitted to the hospital to see what was going on with this, because obviously something was going on. And during that time, that hour or whatever that they went back home to get her a few bits, she collapsed in the bathroom. She went to the toilet, locked herself in, and my dad found her like slumped over on the toilet, basically, and was sort of banging on the door and shouting, Anne, and she wasn't responding. So he actually bashed the door in and found her unconscious. So had to call an ambulance, and then that was when I had the call that, you know, we've taken her to hospital and it's now an emergency situation. So this was all very traumatic, of course. Me being in the UK at the time and this all happening in
and
Malta,
having your own challenges
and having my own challenges, exactly. And I sort of basically was just told to kind of come over ASAP, not sure what's going on. I always just kind of think to myself that sort of things worked out in a way for me to not be, to not having that commitment with work, that I was able to come over, spend some time with my mum, and then also, you know, care for her throughout the illness as things went on. I sometimes think that's why that happened, you know. Excuse me. So whilst you kind of wonder at the time why these things are happening to you,
in hindsight, you can see.
In hindsight, sometimes things do become a little bit clearer, yeah. But essentially, I sort of arrived in Malta several hours later, went straight to the hospital and was told that she had to be basically taken in for an emergency brain surgery. So she was in the intensive care unit and, you know, it was sort of all systems are go. We've got to get her in now, deal with the immediate life and death situation, and then we'll see what the prognosis is later on. Because obviously at this time we didn't really know that she even had a brain tumour or what was going on. We'd only just found that out like a few hours prior. When somebody's unwell, you can just kind of tell from the vibe, from the staff, or people, the teams working in hospitals, it's just sort of a different kind of tone. You know, we were sort of like, oh, thank goodness she's all right. And it kind of like,
you know, oh, wow.
That kind of vibe. So then eventually, once we've had the biopsy and she was recovering from this operation, so then we were told that she had grade 4 glioblastoma, which is the most aggressive form of brain tumour that anyone could have. It's just one of those things that happens, no rhyme or reason to it, just bad luck. And it was at that point that they told us that she had 6 months to live. So again, obviously this was all also news to us. We didn't really even know that she was ill. So it was just...
Because this has only been a couple of weeks.
Yeah, this has only been a couple of weeks since the first kind of... Since she started expressing any symptoms.
You were close to your mum.
I was very close with my mum, yes. She was my bestie.
Which is just beautiful, because we've had this conversation
yes.
before. And I know that this is really emotional for you, and I can and we've talked about it before, and I can see that every time we talk about it, of course, it's still going to evoke
yes.
emotions in you.
It brings a lump to the throat. It's very hard to talk about. Although I do talk about her all the time because she's just so much of who I am, such a big part of who I am.
Can I take this forward? Because this is a whole part of your story that I knew nothing about. Because at the same time, or probably shortly after, you were hitting the headlines in Malta for a very different story.
Yes.
And I invited you, I contacted you, and I said, Emily, can we talk about this headline? The headline was that Emily Jones not only has thousands of Instagram followers, but is also... top 1% of OnlyFans creators.
Oh, yes.
And when we sat down to talk about that story, you had shared the reason why you were in Malta, and suddenly I'm aware of this whole other story that's going on, which is the story about your mum and also your illness.
Yes, well, exactly. It all sort of does tie in, doesn't it? Yeah.
So my question to you is, I mean, you're dealing with your own illness. You're dealing with your physical condition greatly changing. You're a beautiful young lady, but a beautiful young lady who's gained a lot of weight through your illness, through your disability. And at the same time, you've come back to Malta to be with your mum, your dear mum, who's very, very quickly been diagnosed with what I believe was an incurable
yes.
medical condition with cancer.
Yes, yes, it was a terminal condition, yeah.
Explain to me, first of all, I got a couple of questions. I have many questions,
yes.
but one, you know, when I met you, when we sat down, one thing struck me, that you had this big other story that I knew nothing about, but you were still so incredibly cheerful and so incredibly bright. And whilst obviously you're going through all of this agonising pain personally and through things that are happening in your family as well, but then you also have this other story that's hitting the headlines in Malta. Yes. How does this all work? Walk me through that.
Oh, well, yes, I suppose the thing is that there's so many elements, aren't there, to someone's story, and this is why, you know, you really can't kind of make brash judgments about people.
Absolutely.
You know, it's always good to keep an open mind, let's put it that way. But yes, I suppose really what ended up happening is for anybody who doesn't know the story, my mum actually did go on to live for another like 4 years, which was a blessing, but also, you know, a difficult journey in its own way, as I'm sure anyone can understand when somebody has a health condition like that, the deterioration and the sort of stages of the illness, you know, it's very intense. And you start to grieve the person whilst they're still yeah. alive. But, you know, more time with mum was lovely. That was, as I say, I do see that as being the big reason why I had lost my job and why all of that awful stuff was happening to me. Sometimes I think that that must have been my reason why. But, yes, so I found myself basically kind of coming back and forth between Malta and the UK. Obviously, I wasn't working in the UK, but I did live there and, you know, sort of my life was there. But at the same time, I wanted to spend as much time with my mum as possible, needed to support my dad and also, you know, give a hand with her care because it was, you know, it did become a very big job. So I sort of ended up back in my childhood bedroom in Malta and, you know, having quite a lot of kind of time on my hands in a way. I mean, things were very full on with my mum, but at the same time, there was a lot of time that I sort of felt a little bit bored and wondering what I was going to do with myself. And also, again, just thinking about the future and thinking, where is this going? I know that I felt like I couldn't go back into a full-time job anytime soon, wondering how I was going to support myself financially. So I decided to start my Instagram page, and I was following all of these beautiful, curvy, plus-size women that, you know, at the time, like, it was such a big thing that kind of, you know, the plus-size way of life was kind of coming to the forefront. There were so many of these amazing creators and plus-size models, and I just sort of kind of saw myself in them and sort of thought, okay, well, you know, I'm somebody who really, you know, on and off camera, I'm a very confident person, and I've always sort of believed in living life to the full and not letting your insecurities hold you back. So I felt like, okay, I'm going to start documenting this. I'm going to start kind of posting a few bits, expecting that, you know, maybe a few years down the line, I might have a bit of traction somewhere and perhaps I could become a blogger or something. You know, I didn't really know, but I didn't really plan anything about it. I literally was just like, okay, I'm going to take some cute looking photos of myself and I'm going to, you know, pop them up on Instagram and I'm going to put the hashtag like plus size fashion or something. And really that was it. It literally just took off overnight. And then I kind of was in this weird situation where I was like in my childhood bedroom, my parents' house, my mum's going through this, you know, it was just absolutely awful. You can imagine it's like chemo and radiation therapy every single day, like the whole thing. And then on the side, all of a sudden my Instagram page was just kind of blowing up and I'm thinking, oh, that's it, I've made it, that's it, I'm going to become an influencer. You know, it was very, the adrenaline was high, let's put it that way.
I'm trying to work this out. I'm kind of speechless because you've gone through this incredible journey of what I only can imagine is double-folded darkness. Because you're having your own medical issues. You've gone through that issue in the UK. You've lost your job. For anybody who's lost their job through no fault of their own, it is heartbreaking in itself. Yes. And then you've come over, you've got the news of your mum, you're dealing with that as well. And then you've got this absolute dichotomy where suddenly Instagram is blowing up,
yes,
which is all about you, which is, yes, about you was physically. I mean, I'm quite sure that you, or maybe you did, but you weren't writing essays that people were saying, oh, well, you know, what a lovely piece of literature that, yeah, Emily's just written. You might be writing great commentary, but it's related to the visual as well.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think when I first started, actually, I did share quite a lot about positivity through dark times. I did share quite a lot of that journey, actually. But, you know, it kind of becomes one of those things where it's like, okay, you've had your page up for such a long time, you've got so many posts, it all sort of gets a bit lost in the, you know, it's very rare that somebody's going to flick through all of your story highlights to the very end from like years ago and so on. And, you know, you tend to kind of go through and have a bit of a refresh of your page as well and mix things up. But I did start with that because I really was just kind of like, oh, okay, well, I'm here, this is my journey and I'm going to share it. And that's kind of what I did. You know, I'd say things like, I'm having a really rough day with mum at home today. Anyone new here, my mum has a brain tumour, but I'm going out on the slimmer front for a nice walk. Get out there, feel so good, feel the sun on your skin, that kind of vibe, which is very much how I have always kind of lived my life, you know. I think that's something that my mum taught me, really, just to seek pleasure in the small things. You know, it's never, I just don't believe that it's about money, but it's just kind of about how things make you feel, you know, that kind of feeling of going out to the slimmer front and breathing in the fresh sea air and getting a little bit of perspective on things.
Intimissimi, the art of Italian lingerie. We believe beauty lies in the little things, in the softness of our fabrics, in every delicate stitch. Crafted to support your body and spirit, so you feel confident, elegant, and effortlessly yourself. More than form, more than function, designed to celebrate you. Visit us at Tower Road Sliema, Mercury St. Julian's, or online at intimissimi.com.mt.
So let me ask you, you started posting this content, it's, yes, got picked up, you're, yes, telling your story, you're telling your life journey, it's, yes, blowing up. We're talking, yes, about how many followers?
It's hard to say, but I definitely hit around, I think I must have hit around 150,000 within the first like year for sure. But I must have hit my first like 10K followers within a month or so.
Oh my gosh.
I would say something like that. So it was really quick.
Okay, a couple of questions. First of all, what was the magic? What? Because that is...
Well, that's something I would never be able to tell you, Trudy. Miss Jones' magic is a very tightly kept secret.
But what you've just described is that sort of kind of gold that every Instagrammer, every content creator wants. They want that sudden blow up and going from nothing to 10,000 followers in a month.
Actually, I put it down to a couple of things, which are that, number one, I was very, very unapologetically myself. As I say, I never kind of like had anything set up to start or any kind of plan or anything like that. So I literally was just taking pictures inside my parents' home, which, you know, very lovely home, but, you know, it wasn't like sort of an Instagram aesthetic, you know. So it was sort of things like that, or taking pictures, as I say, when I go out on my walk, you know, I'd kind of do, like, have my tripod or prop my phone up against a rock on the beach or something on the slim in front and just snap a few photos. But one thing that I've always maintained throughout my whole time online is that I don't edit anything in terms of, like, face tuning or even colour grading any photos. Like, I don't touch my content in that way ever. I don't use any filters unless it's, like, a very blatant, you know, animal face or something that's very obvious. But things like that, I don't... So I think people found that to be quite refreshing at the time. I think things were quite kind of heavy on the Facetune and this kind of like perfect existence. And I really was just like, I've literally got nothing to lose. And I would just talk about everything and I would just sort of show everything and just be like, you know, very honest about the journey that I was going through. But also with my photos, I think people were kind of... interested to see this kind of unretouched content that I was putting out there. And, you know, when I look back on it now, I think, oh God, why did I ever post that? You know, it's so embarrassing. It looks so unprofessional, like messy bedroom in the background. But, you know, that's why I always say to people, sometimes you can kind of talk yourself out of things. Oh, I haven't got the perfect background now. I can't do that now because I'm waiting for this. You know, but I didn't do any of that. I just said, OK, I'm just going to start and we'll just see, assuming nobody was going to see the pictures anyway. And that's just how it kind of went. I think people resonated with that.
So as your socials are blowing up, was there ever a moment where you just thought to yourself, good grief, what just happened?
I definitely felt like that all throughout the first, like, 6 months or so. Yes, it was very... As I say, I felt like my nervous system was kind of on overdrive because it was sort of like, you know, you get these ting, ting, ting notifications on your phone and it was sort of like I'd go to sleep and be scrolling and thinking, wow, OK, let's see. And then I'd wake up to another, like, 2,000 followers and I'd just be like, what is going on here? Like, it was just very... strange and very kind of, you know, I sort of felt like, right, okay, well, this is obviously what I'm meant to be doing. Like, how can I capitalize on this? Where is this going?
Which is what my next question is, because, of course, having 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 followers on Instagram by itself is not what makes you money.
No.
And it's also not what you hit the headlines for.
No, I suppose not. I think I think people really, like, actually don't really understand how Instagram followers equal, like, money, because they don't. They don't equal money. You have to get work, right? Yes. You have to get brand deals. You have to have paid partnerships with people and so on. And all of that obviously takes up quite a bit of time to sort of get going. As I say, my page had kind of blown up overnight, so I didn't have any kind of brand presence or any awareness of how to handle any of those things. So I was getting, whilst the page was growing, I was getting a lot of offers from, you know, dodgy dealings here and there. I was sort of thinking, okay, that's lots of wasted time on, you know, video calls with people who want to talk to me about something they want me to promote. You know,
just
a lot of time wasted. You learn how to weed those out. But as I say, this is all very new. And people, you know, a few little things here and there, €100 for a tooth whitening product here, you know, a bikini there, things like that. But not enough that you would kind of say, OK, this is, you know, obviously this is how people are making their money on Instagram. So at the time, I was contacted by, I always call her my mentor, because that's kind of what she was with this situation, who sort of said to me, you know, have you ever thought about starting an OnlyFans page? And this was really early in the OnlyFans days. I mean, it was, you know, it hadn't, I think during COVID, it kind of absolutely blew up, but this was sort of just before that. So it was a very interesting time. So I kind of talked to her a little bit about it, and she kind of explained to me that you don't have to do anything on there that you don't want to. Doesn't have to be explicit content, but that you could upload, you know, some behind the scenes of your bikini shoot that maybe, you know, people who are interested in that kind of thing might want to come and see, and sell some extra content there too if you wanted to. So I sort of thought, okay, yeah, let's try it out. Let's give it a go. I said, okay, well, let's see. And that was it, really. And the rest is history. And that's how the OF stuff started.
And that's how you rose to being in the top 1% of OnlyFans creators, which, let's face it, the most recent statistic that I read is that most OnlyFans creators generate probably about 250 euros a month. And that is not sustainable for somebody's income. And a lot of OnlyFans creators also put out a lot of content for that 250 euros a month.
Yes.
But that's not where you're at. You hit the headlines because you got online, you had an identity, you had a niche. Mm. This is who you were. You had embraced this life that you had been dealt, the cards you've been dealt.
Yes.
And you went on as a plus size, it's worth saying.
Yes.
Because you've changed so much since then.
Yes, I suppose.
But just to kind of add that as part of your identity, that was your niche.
It was very much so, yes. It was all about kind of curvy content and plus size content. And, you know, it's very interesting. I always found it very interesting that kind of something that, whilst for me personally, I've certainly had my ups and downs with my body image, but overall, you know, growing up curvier, you know, at that time, things were different. We didn't have that diversity in our social media or media that we consumed. So it was always just like trying to be as slim as possible and just feeling, you know. So it kind of was very interesting that this thing, this body that had kind of caused me so much grief growing up and not being the same size as all of my classmates or other girls my age, and, you know, feeling very self-conscious about these curves, that all of a sudden that was something that was so in demand, so desired. I just felt like it was so kind of empowering and so kind of sexy and strong, and it just felt so great to kind of take that back and sort of be like, yeah, actually, the big girls are out here and we're doing it.
Can I ask you what you learnt in that? Because you've just mentioned you were at school and you didn't fit in.
Yeah.
And then you had this opportunity to embrace this identity that you had, not just embrace it, but to blow up the internet with that. I mean, was there a moment where you thought, take that? Take that, you girls that, you know, gave me a bit of a hard time? Or
I think to a certain extent, I think honestly, I actually felt like that more with like maybe some like local Instagram people in Malta. I think like people kind of just really, I think people really like underestimated me, but also I think people were quite judgmental about things. I think that they thought that, you know, like nowadays I feel the reputation of OF is so different because there's so many huge creators on there, big celebrities who offer exclusive content, you know. People know that it doesn't have to be porn on there. But I think at the time, even though I wasn't doing porn, being on the platform alone was kind of enough for people to have that kind of association. So I felt like there was a lot of kind of clearing up of that I had to do, that I was kind of like, oh, I'm not doing this. But I also feel that people are very judgmental about it in general. I mean, as I say, less these days, but people certainly, there was a lot of, Well, I think when I met you, you were quite surprised by the fact that I'm quite well-spoken. And
good grief. I mean, I said that when I first met you. I think that was the first thing I said, and I certainly said it to myself. I was really surprised.
Yes.
I was really took myself back, and I sat down and said, my goodness, this woman, and also because of the way that media had portrayed you, this woman is incredibly well-spoken, well-educated, articulate, intelligent. And I had made a massive assumption.
Yes.
And me, probably along with an awful lot of other people. And I will say this, though, that whilst you clarify that the content wasn't porn, you're quite a bit of a saucy, sexy young lady.
Wow.
And you do, you can be very suggestive in your content.
Yes.
So I think that possibly is where the one assumption leads to another.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think, you know, it's fair to say that that is also a big part of marketing an OnlyFans page. You know, I mean, nobody's going to want to go and go online and subscribe to your content if you're like, oh, by the way, guys, it's nothing special. You know, you've got to make sure you are offering a little something on there, which, you know, but I think it's kind of all about boundaries and finding out what you're comfortable with and what you're not. And just sort of figuring out where you want to go with it, really. And also the fact that over time that can change. You know, you can maybe decide to, maybe you want to start out with one thing and decide that actually I quite like doing this and I want to do something else. But definitely think people have to be very careful with that when they get started, not to get sucked in. And I have to say, I know we have spoken about this before and there's a lot of content about it online, but, you know, it's this kind of, I would never want to sort of glamorize it in a way that people think that, I think people just have this assumption that you're going to launch an OF page and all of a sudden you're going to be making loads of money. It's just not the case. I mean, even for myself, when I had my sabbatical, I had like a year off after my mum and dad had passed away. That's another chapter. But I had some time off during that time. You know, it's not like if you're not working, the money doesn't just come in. You have to put the content out there, you have to market it, you have to chat to people on the site, you know, you have to kind of keep your fans and your loyal fans happy. It's not just something that suddenly equals easy money. There's quite a lot of work that goes into it. Now, I'm not saying that it's as tough as slogging into an office every day for a 9-to-5, absolutely not, but there's, you know, different sides to every story, aren't there? There's sort of benefits, pros and cons to lots of different things. This sort of just seemed like something that sort of fit with what I was doing at the time, fit my life situation, allowed me to help out with my very stressful home situation, with my mum being unwell, and it just sort of took a little bit of the pressure off and also allowed for me to come off my sickness benefits and start properly contributing to society. So it was just...
This is astonishing, though, because as I'm talking to you, I'm thinking to myself, there are two scenarios here that would seemingly be a disadvantage. And this is what I've always loved about you, Emily. Seemingly be the worst, most tragic news that you could possibly receive.
Yeah.
But in that respect, it has, in hindsight, been to your advantage, or being at least to enable you to take a different path. The first, losing your job with your illness, with your chronic pain, and that coming into effect just before you had to be here, back here in Malta, to be with your mum. And then the second, of course, is, you know, you've got to make yourself an income, and you are mentored by somebody who takes you under the wing and say, listen, okay, you've got this situation where your content has blown up, and let's take it further let's monetize it and let's help you make an income from that. And then that gives you the opportunity to get off benefits and to be able to be there with your family during this very, very difficult time. And I, at the time, I just was then just amazed and just really impressed by your resilience and your depth of resources to be able to work around these situations, because none of us knew that was going on. All we saw was the headlines, Emily Jones, top 1% creator of OnlyFans, when I said, I've got to talk to this woman because I don't know enough about this. Yeah. And then you shared your backstory.
Yes.
I was fangirling all over you. And then there was the post. And I'm going to cry.
Oh, God.
There was the post that you'd lost your mum and you disappeared. And you disappeared for a year and a half. You've just mentioned this sabbatical.
Yeah.
And I had contacted you on the number I had,
I
contacted you through socials. Emily, are you okay? You okay? You okay? You disappeared. Nobody I knew where you were. And then one day you come back online wearing a blue bathing suit.
Yes, that's Lumiere, local brand.
And I said, wow. And I contacted you within minutes of seeing that. Emily, are you okay? And shortly after that, you flew down. We had a sit down and a chat. And I don't want to dive into too much of that because it was a traumatic time of your life. But
yeah,
what happened?
Very much so. Well, then came the, yes, the great, I always say, like, sort of my mum falling ill was the great tragedy of my life, but surprise, there was more to come. So, yes, my mum had started to, you know, her condition was deteriorating, as would be expected with her type of brain tumour, and she did, unfortunately, pass, although we sort of... It felt like the closing of a chapter for sure, but also sort of a little bit of a kind of sense of, I hope she's not suffering anymore. Yeah. You know, it's very hard to see somebody in that kind of situation, especially so young, you know, only like in her 60s and being a very kind of vivacious type of person. It was very hard. But finally, she came to some peace, and then it sort of became about, okay, how's Dad going to cope with all of this? That was always the kind of big worry, because they were extremely close. I mean, their relationship is like such a great romantic love story. I mean, really, goodness me. I mean, he did everything for her, and they were two peas in a pod, absolutely two peas in a pod. So obviously, I was very concerned about how he was going to react once she finally did pass. Or eventually did pass, especially because so much of his day-to-day from the minute she fell ill was so much about caring for her. He was very hands-on with it, so his whole day was filled with, you know, even when she did eventually have to be moved out of the home and into a care facility, it was very much about, I've got to take Anne something for lunch. I need to go and see Anne during my lunch break. He was still working. I need to go and see her after work. You know, just the whole day was just revolving around her needs the whole time. An absolute hero. And 6 weeks after she passed, he died. And he had a heart attack. So, as you can imagine, you know, it's losing one parent is one thing, but then losing both of them within a very short period of time. I mean, it's just, you just couldn't write it. It was just such a tragedy, but it also just kind of felt like he obviously just couldn't stand to be without her. You know, as I say, so sort of tragically romantic. I don't know, it's... he always, like, joked that he couldn't be without her for a minute, you know, and he would sort of sent me... I had sent him a video of them... I'm so lucky I've got all of these beautiful videos of these sweet moments between them that I kind of captured when they weren't aware of it, things like when he would be kind of feeding her something that he brought her that he knew that she would like, and these kind of tender moments between them. And I came across one on my phone and I sent it to him after she'd passed, and he sort of said something back to me like, oh gosh, I can't stand to hear her voice. Wow. It kills me. It kills me, you know. So I'm just like, it's just so, it's almost like it was written, you know. It was so crazy to just think that he just sort of obviously just couldn't cope with it. And it was also just kind of crazy timing that he'd sort of somehow, obviously, he did have a heart attack, but the fact that throughout all of her illness, he never had any, you know, issues of his own. He just sort of threw everything, poured everything into taking care of her. And it was almost like now that that job is done, he sort of had a minute to kind of sit back. I don't know. I don't know what to say about it, honestly, Trudy.
But it's you had mentioned before when we spoke, it was almost as if he had passed away from heartbreak.
Yes.
He just was heartbroken, quite literally.
Yes,
heartbroken.
That's certainly how it felt. And I mean, and he was, you know, he was completely lost without his Anne. They were just like obsessed with each other.
And this must have been incredible grief. Incredible grief for you.
Yes.
Because I think it's worth mentioning that this is a succession of devastating circumstances over and over and over and over again. So was there ever a time where you said, I'm just going to soldier on, I'm just going to keep going? Or did you say, OK, I need to let grief sit with me and I'm going to take a sabbatical? How did you come to that decision?
Yeah, I think I just felt at that time that I didn't really have anything to share. I didn't have anything to give. I had been very focused on trying to pass on some positivity through dark times, and I just kind of felt like I didn't really have that at that time. And I just sort of felt...
Which comes back to where you started your Instagram, right at the very beginning. It's about truth. You were very truthful. You were very honest. You were very, this is me. This is what I look like. This is who I am.
That's right.
And then... without pretending.
Yes. So I just kind of felt that I kind of didn't have it in me to give that, to deal with opinions, to deal with any kind of outside... Well, not exactly criticisms, but just any feedback. You know, I just kind of felt like I needed to sort of cocoon myself a little bit and just really be kind to myself and just take time to sort of just do nothing, which I was very kind of lucky to be able to do. But I just didn't have anything to give, so I just couldn't. I just felt like I needed to kind of center myself a little bit and figure out where things were. Before coming back online. But I suppose I always thought that I probably would come back, but it just never really felt right until the blue bikini.
Well, what happened with the blue bikini? What was that moment? What was the circumstances that led you to say, okay, I'm coming back online in a blue bikini, here I am, back and there's my face and I'm smiling?
Well, I think what happened, although I'm not so sure, but I'm pretty sure that what happened was that Lumia, who are a Maltese swimwear brand, a local brand who I had been working with from their kind of conception a couple of years before, and I was very happy to support them. Absolutely amazing Maltese designs, just wonderful to support a local business run by this young woman. She's amazing. And they were very, very keen to sort of work with people with all kinds of different body types. They were making sort of these suits with great support for large chested ladies. It was just great. They just, you know, really nailed it. Sort of their vision was very much in line with mine, and it was a pleasure working with them. And I'm pretty sure that they reached out and kind of said, hey, like, you know, would you be interested, like, are you coming to Malta anytime soon, and do you want to maybe work together on our new collection? And I think I sort of just felt that as a little bit of a kind of call to be like, yeah, actually, I think I would. I was obviously bored out of my mind at this point and just sort of looking for, you know, to sort of start feeling like myself again. And and that's how it started. So that really was how I got back to it. They had some amazing new designs and I felt fantastic in them, even though, you know, people are talking a lot now about kind of my ups and downs with my weight, because I have lost a significant amount of weight following my gastric bypass last year. But at that time, I had actually gained quite a lot of weight from where I had last left Instagram. But again, that's not something that I kind of like talked about, because it's sort of just, it's just part of life, isn't it? You have ups and downs. Wasn't like so much of a big deal for me. It was just kind of like, okay, well, I'm coming back online now, you either.
And what happened when you came back online?
Well, what did happen? I mean, things kind of picked up pretty quickly. I mean, you do have to kind of get back into it and start sort of posting regularly, and everything had changed. I felt like such an old lady, because all of a sudden it was like video content was where it was at. And at the time when I came offline, it was only photo posts, you know, so the lay of the land had changed. But it kind of felt like coming home.
Your fans welcomed you back.
Yeah, they did. They did. And I think a lot of them were quite happy to see that I'd packed on some pounds as well. My curve-loving fans, you know, were very happy to see that, I think.
Well, you see, this leads me beautifully into the kind of final transformation of Emily Jones. For now,
I'm pretty sure for now.
Because you came back online and you were taking a bit of a different angle. There was a lot of travel content. You were pushing towards that. And then I sat down with you beginning of last year, and I had seen that you were coming back to Malta. I think you'd mentioned you were coming back to Malta, and something in my head said, I think Emily's going to be making a bit of a radical change.
Yes.
And I asked you quietly, and you said, how did you know? And I said, I don't know, I just guessed.
Yeah,
because you decided to opt for a gastric bypass.
Yes, I did.
Which, bearing in mind, and this is how I see it, and I know that we've talked about this and kind of how you see yourself is different to how other people might see you.
Yeah, I think so.
But bearing in mind that a lot of your audience on Instagram and also on OF, on OnlyFans, was very much drawn towards your larger size, your thick thighs, as you talk about all the time, and you decide to radically change all of that. So I guess I'm wondering why. What led that decision?
Oh, well, it was a very, quite a difficult decision to make, honestly. I did kind of agonise about it and sort of went back and forth with it so much. And, you know, I've documented a lot of this on my TikToks. There's a lot of kind of videos from just before my bypass where I was sort of getting very upset about it and questioning whether it was going to be the right thing to do. And really just kind of crying out for my mum. I just wanted to talk to her about it. You know, it was very hard to not... Just wanted to sort of have her opinion on it. Felt like I kind of felt a little bit like I wanted everyone's opinion on it. But ultimately, I guess I came to the realisation that the only opinion that really mattered was my own.
Yeah.
I did know that it was going to impact things, but I just kind of had this feeling that things would work out. They have before, they tend to, things fall in place, you evolve, you move with the times, you move with the circumstance. So I just sort of felt like I had to have a little bit of faith in myself and remember what it is that, you know, I've known all along, which is that, you know, I'm so much more than my body. Yes, that was a big part of my brand. I always want to encourage people to sort of like get out there and live their best life. It didn't necessarily have to be for people who were plus size. Like, obviously, people will take that as, you know, that you have like a plus size role model or a plus size content creator to see yourself represented in them. And I'll never sort of turn my back on that. But it was never really about that. It was more about embracing anything that society might deem as an insecurity or a flaw, and sort of embracing that, putting it to the side or even sort of putting it to the forefront and just absolutely kind of like living 100% authentic to yourself and living your best life regardless of the ups and the downs. That was kind of always the message. So I just sort of felt like I really had to have a bit of faith in myself and say, you know, come on, Emily, you are so much more than this. There's so much more to give. And if people want to follow with the new journey, the new you, if you want to call it that, although as I maintain that I'm still the same person on the inside, then come along for the ride. I'm going to be doing this. If you want to follow, follow. If it's not for you, that's fine. But ultimately, you cannot live your life around other people or thinking about what other people kind of want from you. You've just got to do what's going to work out best for you. And that's what felt like the right thing for me at the time.
Which is amazing. But I've got to ask you.
Yes.
Have they come with you for the ride?
Yeah, I would say a lot of them have. I think a lot of people... I think it's also kind of interesting because with my weight loss, I now have kind of like unlocked a whole new sort of realm of, again, these kind of societal flaws or whatever you want to kind of call it. You know, I have a lot of loose skin. I've got a lot of stretch marks. I mean, I've always had those, but I've got stretch marks. I've got loose skin. You know, almost sometimes that can seem like something that you would more want to cover up than even being overweight in a bikini, you know, kind of like the sagging skin and things. It's a new thing to have to kind of get used to. And again, you know, it's something that, am I going to change it in the future? Am I going to look into maybe having some plastics eventually? If there's something I can't sort of improve on my own, then maybe. But the point is that in this phase, in the in-between, I'm still getting out there. I'm still doing everything that I want to do, and I'm not sort of letting that hold me back. And I think that's kind of really the message that I want to put out there, that, you know, it doesn't matter what your insecurities are. They might be not even perceived as insecurities to other people. But if it's something that you're bothered about, that's kind of the most important thing, that you need to sort of learn to overcome that and not let it hold you back.
Yeah.
And I think that this circumstance, just seeing kind of, particularly with my mum, but also with my dad, the fact that life can change in an instant, your life situation can change in an instant. You know, it's life's so short and so beautiful and magical, and there's so many amazing things to experience. It's such a shame that we won't kind of get our flabby arms out to feel the sun on our skin during the summer months because we're too afraid of doing that. It's just such a shame. It's just such a shame not to kind of experience all of the rich, amazing things that life has in store for us. And to kind of not experience that just because you're kind of insecure about some stretch marks or some cellulite or something, it's like we all need to learn to be better with that.
Is that where the source of your resilience comes from? Because as I've said, and one of the reasons that I love sitting down to talk to you is that there's just this repetition of resilience, repetition of, you know, this has knocked me down, but I'm going to come back up. It would have been so easy for you so many times along the way just to give up, just to say, okay, I'm done. You know what, I'm going to buy myself a little bungalow with a cat and I'm going to stay there and I'm going to get everything delivered to me. But you didn't do that. You actually embraced everything and showed true resilience. Where does that come from?
Well, thank you, first of all. It's very flattering to hear. I mean, I think I've always sort of have given myself the grace to grieve, the space to have self-care time and take what I needed. But honestly, I just don't feel that that's even an option. I mean, if you don't sort of push against it and if you're not resilient, what's the other option? You know, certainly not going to let some tragic life situation take away from my own life. I'm not sure really. I'm not sure. I think I've kind of always been that sort of type of person naturally, but I do think that a lot of my kind of life circumstances, I think it's also important to say that you see things differently, I think, once you get through one of these nasty life situations. So the fact that I saw that eventually things kind of worked out with my work and my health issues, and once you sort of overcome some different hurdles, I think you sort of start to realise that actually, you know, there's not much that you can't take on.
Absolutely.
So I think that life experience is really important for that.
And I think you've hit one massive nail on the head, because I think that we miss this so often, is that you can take courage from any situation, anything that you overcome. It might be, you know, I didn't feel that I could walk down this street because there's a barking dog and it scares me. Once you've done it once, you've got that in your belt, you can do it again.
That's right.
And you can then up that to the next level.
That's right.
And keep going. And that's exactly as you've just described.
Yes, I think so. I think that's definitely something that's kind of, I think, marked out my path. And also that's something that just hearing you say that, that's kind of also taking me back to this thing about confidence, that I just really believe that confidence is like the secret sauce to like everything in life. Because I just believe if you work on confidence and you're a confident person, you can sort of, you can do anything. You can do anything if you just really believe in yourself enough. But what I always tell people when they sort of comment on my Instagram, I wish I was as confident as you and so on, you know, it's a muscle. You've got to train it. You've got to sort of put yourself in those situations outside of your comfort zone that then builds your confidence. You realise that you can get through it. You've done it once, you can do it again, and you can do the next thing that's even scarier than that as well. And it's all going to be fine. Like, it's going to be fine. You've just sort of got, I think, to take a little bit of perspective of a situation. I think a lot of these kind of tragedies or life situations, difficult life situations, have given me a lot of perspective on things. And I think that's kind of changed how I deal with things.
Well, last question, Emily Jones, what is next?
What's next? Well, you mentioned that I'm working a lot on my travel content at the moment. This is something that I'm so passionate about. I've been talking about it all over the place.
This is the content where you go and lie on the beach and then...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that easy job. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I'm very happy that it looks so effortless, but it certainly requires a little bit more coordination behind the scenes. But again, it's something that I'm very happy to be doing. And, I'm extremely passionate about showing diversity, different body types, different content types in different parts of the world. So I just feel like when you are looking to book a holiday somewhere, looking at a luxury hotel and so on, you're sort of looking through the media, it's very often that you don't see yourself or your family represented in the images that people are using for marketing, and just feel that it makes people feel that they don't belong in those types of settings. So I think I'm just really keen to kind of show that all types of people belong in these luxury travel settings, and that you deserve to sort of get out there and see the world and feel comfortable doing it just as much as the next person, or as much as those perfect looking people on Instagram that we see all over the hotel travel feeds and around this travel content that is so, sometimes feel like it's so kind of lacking in personality. You know, it's very much sort of this perfect looking couple in their sort of white outfits, walking hand in hand down a pristine beach. And travel is not always like that. And it's, that's not the beauty of travel. Sometimes it's more about the gritty reality of things. And I think I'm just really keen to kind of put my experiences out there, but also just to say that this is something that for me, I felt that I couldn't travel very much when, you know, obviously when I was unwell, and then never wanting to really stray very far from my mum's side during her illness, which ended up being a lot longer than expected. So I think I sort of just have tried to embrace this kind of feeling of, I think when your parents pass away, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, that you do struggle a little bit with this kind of concept of home. Mm. That for me, home would probably always be like where my parents were. Certainly coming back to Malta and arriving at the airport and not having one of them pick you up is, you know, a bit of a soul-crushing experience, especially when you're grieving. Things feel very different. Things feel somewhat empty, and you feel that there's no kind of grounding. So I think I've sort of decided that I'm going to embrace that feeling and try to see as much of the world as I can during this time that I can, where I'm feeling good physically, you know, my health is in a good place, work is going well, and it's just sort of, I have the freedom to do that. So, okay, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to share my experiences with the world, and I'm going to show you that even if you covered in cellulite from top to toe and you've got loose skin and you've got bingo wings, that you deserve to get out there, go to the luxury resort, feel your toes in the sand, and that you deserve to be there confidently just as much as anyone else does.
Emily, you're such a warrior. Thank you so much for sitting and sharing your journey and everything that has gone into making you who you are.
Yeah, it's wonderful to talk with you, Trudy. Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure.
We're done.